and a dash of jealousy, whipped together by a stressful morning, was a recipe for bad behavior. Susan tried sweetening her comment. The Hamptons is preppy chic, right? It's the perfect top for out here. She gestured toward her jeans and t-shirt ensemble. I plan to shower and change into something more appropriate after we get settled. Put on a little makeup myself. We're on vacation, right? Jenny pushed her sunglasses to the crown of her head, revealing her soft brown eyes. You don't need all this paint to look good. And that, Susan thought, was why she'd invited Jenny to the Hamptons, even though she didn't know her that well, and her sons would probably never befriend the Murray's preteen daughter. Jenny, unlike so many of the other moms she'd met in their new town, didn't act as though she was too good for anyone, even though she, out of all the people in the neighborhood, could have gotten away with it. The social hierarchy of East Coast suburban moms, Susan had learned, mimicked high school. Stay-at-homes who regularly ran out the door without their hair brushed, as Susan so often did, were the wallflowers of her new world. Harried working moms were the nerds, begrudgingly respected, though not particularly admired or envied. Ladies who lunched, aka stay-at-home moms with staff, were the popular girls who planned lavish charity events and shared all the relevant gossip. At the top of the ladder, however, were the women like Jenny, who somehow juggled successful careers and still showed at school functions and fundraisers, looking like they'd spent all day at the salon. They were the prom queens. Let's get the booze out of the sun. Nadal was again cradling the cases in his arms. Susan became aware of her dry throat. A glass of wine would surely take the edge off her house tour. She held her breath as she entered, with Jenny steps behind. Plasterboard, painted the stark white of a gallery, narrowed the small foyer into a tight corridor. On Susan's right, two oak slabs hung from a track, like long slabs of meat. Jenny slid back the first door, revealing a crowded bathroom. The second door had been left half covering the opening, possibly because the room behind it would have made anyone claustrophobic otherwise. It barely appeared large enough for the full bed inside. Susan caught Jenny's nostrils flare beneath her cat-eye sunglasses. This will be fine for Nadal and me, Susan said. She'd booked the place after all. If she'd done a horrible job, the least she could do was agree to take the worst bedroom. Susan headed deeper into the house, her fear that she'd fallen for a scam increasing with each step. Perhaps the owners had posted images lifted from a realty site and populated their rental page with fake reviews. Could she get everyone's money back if she could prove fraud? She hadn't read the fine print on the agreement. The photos showed a ton of windows. Where? The house responded to Susan's unfinished question, opening into a great room with a double-height cathedral ceiling and a far wall constructed almost entirely of glass. Tall French doors composed the base of the transparent expanse. Above them, trapezoidal panes of graduating sizes met at a pentagonal center window. Beyond the wall, a deep sapphire pool sparkled in an emerald setting. Relief flowed through Susan's tightened throat like a good glass of Cabernet. It's beautiful. Louis! Jenny yelled over her shoulder. Come take a look at this! Susan couldn't stop looking. Beyond the lawn, a patch of scrub forest separated the backyard from a blue field of sea and sky. The beach was right there, as promised. A doorbell rang. Nadal's voice reverberated in the high ceilings from somewhere behind her. I'll get it. Susan rested her gaze from the view to take in the rest of the house. The furnishings in the great room were sparse but elegant. A U-shaped sectional faced a brick fireplace pressed against what appeared to be the barn's original stone wall, Behind it stood a farmhouse dining table in the same pale oak as the ceiling beams. The kitchen, identifiable by its white cabinets and stainless steel appliances, hid behind the dining area at the front of the house. It was separated from the great room by the plasterboard wall that had made up one side of the cramped hallway and a low ceiling supporting the second story. Most of the upstairs had been left open, a loft tucked beneath the elongated slope of the salt box's roof. Two glass panels, each of which stopped at chest height, cordoned off a furnitureless mezzanine leading to what Susan assumed were the second floor bedrooms.
"Susan, look at this place."
Ben Hansen emerged from the hallway, the strap of his bag slung between his large pectorals. He opened his arms toward her, offering a hug. She dove in for one, suddenly overwhelmed by the resurgence of her earlier gratitude when he'd carried Jonah, in full meltdown mode, from the crowd. A second into the embrace, she realized how her enthusiasm might look to Ben's wife and pulled away, awkwardly double-tapping her neighbor's back to decrease intimacy. Ben had a face that called for a camera. Perfectly symmetrical, with a strong nose, diamond jaw, and dark blue eyes that appeared deeply interested in whomever they focused on. Such handsomeness made any congeniality from the opposite sex appear coquettish, probably because on some level, it was. Susan needed to be extra careful around him, especially around alcohol. Acting too friendly, a glass or two in, had gotten her into enough trouble back in Seattle.
"So, how are we doing the sleeping arrangements?"
Lewis set a wine box on the kitchen counter and then huffed over to the staircase. With white steps, the same shade as the walls, and a single glass side topped with a near-invisible metal banister, the freestanding structure seemed to float above the concrete floor.
"We don't know."
Nadal re-entered the great room with Ben in tow.
"The only claimed space is the wine fridge."
Lewis gestured upstairs with his chin.
"I'll toss these anywhere, then."
He hustled up the steps at a pace that made Susan nervous, given the staircase's open side. When he reached the mezzanine, he turned a sharp left toward the smaller of the two bedrooms, which offered an ocean view.
Maybe we should ask what everyone wants to do,
Jenny shouted up the stairs. Lewis looked down at her over the railing.
"I want to ditch the bags, Jen. What did you stuff in here anyway? 5 outfits for every day of the week?"
Jenny's red lips pursed. "Well, a girl's got to be prepared for anything," Susan said, gesturing to the large duffel at her hip, as though it contained only her clothing and not also all of Nadal's things. "Who knows what we might get up to? Dinners in town, dancing, celebrity house parties?" She nudged Jenny, making clear that the celebrity to which she referred was already in the house.
"I do love my celebrities."
Lewis grinned at his wife, eliciting an eye roll from Jenny, along with a small smile that said he'd been forgiven. Susan recognized the exchange as the kind of thing that passed between her and Nadal all the time. Someone said something to annoy the other one. The aggrieved party arched his or her back like a hissing cat, and then both people moved on. Marriage was like a poker game in that the stakes increased the longer each player sat at the table. After a dozen years with the same person, the pot became so large that no one could walk away over anything less than a monumental display of cheating. All other grievances had to be shrugged off.
"So what are we drinking?"
Rachel's voice snapped Susan's attention back from the second floor. Her neighbor strode into the great room on heeled espadrilles, like a native New Yorker in Midtown, oblivious to the sights around her. When she reached Ben, she made pointed eye contact, as though he were the designated bartender.
"I need a large glass of something. That call was brutal."
Ben pulled the strap of his weekender bag over his head.
"I'm going to put our stuff in the downstairs bedroom. My bum knee has been acting up lately. Makes stairs a pain."
Rachel grimaced at her husband's leg and then turned toward the rest of the group.
Jen, maybe you can give him another cortisone shot.
Jenny frowned. Doctors really shouldn't inject the tissue too often, and I really shouldn't be giving shots at all since I'm not technically practicing at the moment. There's a bit of a liability issue.
Rachel double-slapped her husband's thigh, a jockey sending a stallion on his way.
That's why I like having you treat him. If anything happens, I know you're good for it.
She headed into the kitchen.
So, what's on tap?
Nadal crouched beside the cabinets, unloading bottles into a wine fridge.
Pick your poison, guys, he shouted. Sauvignon Blanc, Riesling, Rosé, Red, Whiskey.
The mention of a drink made Susan's mouth water. Since the move, Cabernet had become her anti-anxiety medication. Without a hefty dose, she'd keep thinking about the twins and worrying about the bedroom sizes, obsessing over whether her husband's determined focus on the wine bottles and not on Rachel striding toward him was because he found their neighbor disconcertingly attractive.
We brought champagne.
Rachel glanced behind her, perhaps for Ben with their suitcases. He'd already disappeared down the hallway, though he'd left a pink and green checkered bag on the coffee table that looked suspiciously like it held a bottle of something. Red relaxed Susan best, but she knew most people didn't drink it on sunny days.
How about the rosé?
Nadal pulled a bottle of pink from the open box.
Wolfer Estate it is. This is a good one. Local.
He pulled a corkscrew from a drawer and slashed the paper at the top of the bottle. Susan realized she should be making conversation and not ogling the wine like a dehydrated man before a mirage. She was a former lawyer, and Rachel was still one. There was common ground to explore.
So, Rachel, you had a work call? Big case?
Rachel was also watching Nadal. She turned her focus from him as he jammed the screw into the stopper.
I'm not out for blood or anything, but it could be. I'm hoping to settle it amicably before it goes to court and ends up a big thing in the papers.
Nadal yanked the cork out like he was mad at it.
Honey, grab some glasses.
Susan opened the cabinet above the wine fridge, the obvious location for them. A line of thick wine glasses stood on the bottom shelf. She grabbed one, realizing as her nails struck the stem that it had been constructed out of plastic. Susan slipped the stems of two glasses between the fingers of her right hand and then reached in for more.
A big thing in the papers, huh?
She raised her voice so that Rachel could hear her.
Did someone really get injured?
Rachel groaned. Died, actually. A 9-year-old boy. Susan's breath caught in her chest. She imagined her son's faces from that morning, Jamal's winning smile and Jonah's searching eyes. The wine no longer seemed appealing.
Oh my God, that's horrible.
She turned her full attention back to Rachel.
What happened?
Nadal set the bottle on the table with a hard thud. The cork was in his hand, speared through by the screw. Rachel glanced at him and then quickly shifted her gaze back to Susan.
I shouldn't even be talking about it. Attorney-client privilege. And we're on vacation, right? No work talk.
Discussing dead children admittedly wasn't a way to start a vacation. But Susan did want to know what had happened to the poor little boy. Hearing about the case had set her mind racing with all the dangers facing 9-year-old kids. Dangers that she, hundreds of miles away, couldn't protect either of her twins from. Susan set four glasses on the counter beside Nadal.
Sorry to bring up work. It's just, God, that poor boy. His poor mother.
Rachel's irises blurred into a watery blue. I know. She sniffed. Every time I talk to her, I think of Will. It's,
so, vacation.
Nadal said it with forced enthusiasm, an umpire calling a strike.
He lifted the wine dramatically and began filling the row of glasses.
Some view, huh?
Rachel murmured her appreciation as Susan returned to the cabinet for two more glasses, resigned to dropping the subject. She'd asked Nadal not to bring up work. Grilling Rachel on her new case wasn't exactly playing fair.
No wine for me yet.
Susan looked up to see Jenny hovering by the wall of windows.
I'm going to check out the beach. Jenny continued. Tell Lois?
Before Susan could answer, Jenny was through the French doors in the glass wall. The sound of them shutting was followed almost immediately by the slide of the first floor bedroom door. Ben's heavy footsteps thudded on the concrete floor. The house carried sound throughout the great room, Susan realized. She hoped it wouldn't make sleeping difficult. Susan brought a fifth glass from the cabinet in case Lewis also wanted a drink when he came downstairs. Nadal stopped pouring and handed her a glass. He grabbed his own and raised it in the air.
To my wife, his mouth spread in a sappy smile. I know this year hasn't been easy with the move and not having the right school for Jonah or the family help that we're used to, not to mention me working around the clock to expand the company. Yet you still planned this vacation for all of us. I hope you have a chance to truly enjoy it and relax. You deserve it.
The saccharine speech embarrassed Susan. Nadal knew that she didn't enjoy being the focus of attention. Rachel was staring at her with one of those gluey grins. Susan might have planned the trip, but Rachel, like Nadal and Jenny and Lewis, had worked to pay for it. Susan said a quick thanks and raised her own glass.
To new friends, and taking a leap of faith going in on this sublet with us for the week. I hope this vacation is the first of many.
Rachel's real smile unlocked as their plastic glasses tapped together. Nadal set his untouched wine back on the table. For a second, Susan could have sworn she'd caught her husband scowling at her toast.
I should see if Lewis needs a drink.
Chapter 4. The Day After. The shore was a surreal place for a crime scene. Something about the reflection of the sky in the encroaching ocean, the way the unbroken blue above shimmered at the water's mirrored edge. It disoriented Gabby, made her feel flipped upside down. Police tape, neon yellow in the white morning, pulled at the spikes cordoning off a square area in front of a wall of black boulders. The jetty extended into the sea like the enormous fin of some prehistoric whale. Detective Jason DeMarco stood outside the designated area, identifiable, despite Gabby's distance, by the black hair shining like sealskin atop his skull. His head bobbed along to the gestures of two khaki-clad officers, semi-camouflaged by the sandy landscape. County had apparently sent a forensic team. Gabby's clumpy pumps sank into the loose sand as she tried, and failed, to jog toward her colleague. Each step kicked hot grains up beneath the hem of her pants. It would have been easier barefoot, but she couldn't show up to her first murder looking like a misguided tourist. By the time she reached the trio of officers, her calves itched from the sand pasted to her skin. She ignored the feeling as Jason introduced her to the county team as Detective Sergeant Gabby Watkins. The addition of her full name added heft to the title, as did the authoritative tenor of Jason's dropped voice. Neither forensic officer shook her outstretched hand as they provided their names and ranks. Gabby dropped her arm without taking offense. Both men wore bright blue latex gloves, and touching her bare, sweaty palm could unwittingly transfer her DNA onto the body.
She was killed late last night.
Captain Dennis Lee remained standing for his explanation, while his partner crouched to snap photographs of the scene with the massive digital SLR hanging from his neck. Lee was evidently the elder statesman, with his gray-streaked black hair and hooded, downturned eyes, the skin at the corners exploding with lines as he squinted in the bright sun. He also outranked Gabby by 2 degrees, which meant she shouldn't interrupt his update with questions. Gabby pulled out her notebook from an interior pocket of her navy suit jacket, along with a pen. She flipped over several pages, skipping the scrawled thoughts she'd jotted down earlier that morning in Dinah's house, and stared at Lee, ready to take dictation.
"We can't determine the exact time of death yet," he went on, "because we don't know how long she was in the water. The ocean would have brought down her body temp pretty quickly. Given her location, I figure she was killed a couple hours before high tide when there was water here. So, say around midnight. Certainly no later than 1.
Gabby turned her attention from Captain Lee to the victim. The woman was petite, more the size of a girl than a grown adult. She was propped up against the jetty, her head drooping as though she read an invisible book on her lap. Her silvery blonde hair gleamed in the sunlight, long dried from whenever she'd been underwater. If police tape hadn't surrounded the woman, Gabby might have passed her by, assuming she'd simply nodded off while sunbathing in her white one-piece. Closer inspection, however, betrayed that something was very wrong. One strap of the victim's white bathing suit had been snapped from her shoulder. Her fair skin had been rendered near translucent with faint blue lines, like cheap notebook paper. Gabby took a step toward the other side of the body in hopes of spying the signs of a water death that were so apparent to Lee. The victim's thighs, she realized, were porcelain only on top. An eggplant color crept from underneath, where the blood had settled. "Did you detect water in the lungs?" Gabby asked. Lee said something to his younger, stockier partner in medical terms too fast for Gabby to fully comprehend. The man put his gloved hand beneath the victim's chin and raised it an inch. So many red and purple splotches dotted the neck that the pale skin between looked like a Baroque pearl necklace.
"She was clearly asphyxiated, though determining whether from drowning or strangulation, we'll have to wait for the autopsy. Judging from the size of the neck bruises and the abrasions on her knees, she was likely held underwater by a larger, or at least significantly stronger, assailant standing behind her with his palms pressing on the clavicle and fingers against her windpipe."
Lee transferred his attention from the body to Gabby.
"Unfortunately, she's only about your height, and obviously petite, so that doesn't narrow the field much. The average American man is 5'10", and the typical female is still a couple inches taller than the victim. Overpowering her wouldn't have taken much strength."
Lee nodded decisively, as if to dismiss her. Gabby turned toward her fellow detective. Jason had been listening to the forensic expert while grinding his bottom lip beneath his top teeth. He glared at the victim as though she'd ruined his afternoon. "Who placed the call?" Gabby asked. Jason rotated toward the grass-covered dunes dividing the houses from the beach. A man stared at the crime scene from the sand in front of the vegetation. He was dressed for a run in a t-shirt and tight bike shorts. Gabby put his height at over 6 feet. His size, coupled with his apparent athleticism, heightened her senses. The man could be a threat if he wanted to be. He could hold a woman underwater.
"Nadal Ahmadi," Jason said, "says he's renting a house with the victim, her husband, another couple, and his wife. The woman, Officer Kelly, is over there watching. She was pretty worked up."
A few feet behind Nadal, the shorter uniformed patrolman was sitting with a woman who must have been the wife. She had long mouse brown hair and skin that was reddening in the sun. She wore shorts and a t-shirt. Her head was drooped toward her lap, perhaps to avoid seeing her friend's body.
"You said they found her on a jog?"
Gabby started toward the couple, knowing that the sooner she spoke with them, the better. It wasn't unusual for people who called 911 to be guilty of something or to know more than they'd told the dispatcher. She needed to talk to them before they conferred about their story, assuming they hadn't already.
I gather they went out around 8.
Jason pointed in the opposite direction of the people.
Their rental is about a quarter mile that way.
More grains of sand sprayed Gabby's calves as she moved away from the packed sand towards the victim's friends. Jason withdrew his own notebook from the duty belt visible around his hips. Most detectives didn't bother with the heavy getup, opting to clip their gun holster and cell phones onto a regular leather belt and pocket a couple of zip ties for emergency arrests. But Jason seemed comfortable with all the artillery around his waist, despite the added weight and the overbearing heat. Gabby was secretly glad one of them could stand it.
The victim is Rachel Klein, he said. The man is Nadal Ahmadi. He claims he checked for a pulse on the neck and didn't find one. His wife, Susan Ahmadi, has calmed down from earlier.
Jason abruptly stopped talking as they drew within 10 feet of the pair. Gabby copied the names into her notebook, peering over her colleague's bent arm to check spelling. When she finished, she tilted her head in Susan's direction. Women often did better talking to other women, particularly when they were afraid. You take the husband. Gabby made eye contact with the uniformed officer and pointed to Jason, indicating that he should follow his lead. She then continued toward Susan, holding her notebook out to de-emphasize the gun strapped to her hip. Ms. Ahmadi, I'm Detective Gabriella Watkins. I'd like to ask you some questions. The eyes that met Gabby's were noticeably dry, though the red lines snaking from the woman's hazel green irises suggested she'd shed tears at some point. Gabby thought her attractive, in a kind of girl next door got married and had a couple kids way, the same way Gabby considered herself attractive. She and Susan didn't have the dewy complexions and Pilates bodies of many of their Hamptons counterparts, but they'd been born with a certain appeal and had more or less maintained it. I understand that the victim is Rachel Klein. How do you know her? She's our neighbor. Susan pressed her fingers into her temples and slowly circled them, massaging away a headache. Her son, Will, and my boys are friends. We're all renting a house together.
You and who else?
Jenny and Lewis Murray, our other neighbors. Susan kept rubbing her forehead.
You all live on the same block?
Susan lifted her left sneaker from the sand and stamped the sloped ground in front of her. She leaned over to carve an X with her index finger into the grains. We moved here. She scrawled another X in the sand beside it. The Murrays, Jenny and Lewis and their daughter, are here. Behind the second letter, she made another mark. Rachel and Ben live behind them with their two kids. Our backyards all touch. She coughed and covered her mouth, taking a moment before continuing. We thought, with the kids all in camp, we could pool resources and get a house on the beach for the week.
When was the last time you saw Rachel?
Susan unfurled her folded legs and placed a hand on her stomach. With her limbs stretched out, Gabby could tell she was tall. If Susan stood, she'd tower over her. Rachel was with us all last night. She took a deep breath. She went out for a walk around 10.
Alone?
She was... A second cough interrupted her, followed by a loud internal gurgling. Susan flipped onto her knees and pressed her palms to the ground, arching her back. A harsh retching followed. The sound of his wife vomiting worked like an alarm for her husband. Out of the corner of her eye, Gabby saw him shoot between the two officers, his hands already reaching for Susan. Detective DeMarco jogged to catch him.
She's sick.
The husband didn't exactly yell, but his voice was elevated. He glared at DeMarco's hand as it gripped his shoulder.
The sergeant will handle it.
Gabby put up a hand, urging both of them to stop. She dropped her notebook and gathered Susan's brown hair off the back of her neck, keeping it from the stream of thick yellow bile splattering the sand. The sour smell reminded her of the yeasty sweat that stunk up the jail Sunday mornings. After a minute of hurling, Susan settled back onto her haunches.
I'm sorry.
Her face cracked like a porcelain doll's.
I'm so sorry.
Gabby released her hair. I'm sorry for your loss. Susan gazed at her as if the platitude surprised. She slumped back on the slope of the dune.
God, Will is only 9, and Chloe adores Rachel.
She wiped the heel of her hand beneath her watering nose.
Ben will have to break it to them, and he doesn't even know.
Gabby dipped down to reclaim her notebook and pen from the sand. She wrote Ben's first name and then asked for the spelling of the surname Hansen, along with the name of the town where they all lived. Years of handling sexual assault calls had taught Gabby that violence against women was often perpetrated by intimate partners. She'd have to check Ben Hansen for prior violent arrests.
He'll have to get his kids from camp.
Susan rubbed her sandy hands beneath her eyes, streaking grit across her cheeks.
They're in Maine.
Ms. Amati, Gabby hardened her tone. She needed the woman to stop with the kids and start in on the parents. You said Rachel went for a walk last night around 10. Did she go alone? Susan put a hand over her mouth, as though she might be sick again.
Yes,
she said, once she'd settled.
We thought it was a safe area.
Her husband didn't go with her?
Gabby let a note of incredulity into her voice. Safe neighborhood or not, most of the men Gabby knew wouldn't feel comfortable having their petite spouse trekking along a strange beach at night by herself. Gabby's husband certainly wouldn't want her doing it, and she carried a gun.
Ben had gone to talk to her earlier, but he'd already come back by then.
Susan pointed toward the jetty propping up the victim's body.
I saw Rachel still out there while I was cleaning up the dinner plates in the yard.
Gabby continued writing, even as she realized that Susan's statement indicated something unfortunate had occurred between Ben and his wife. What time was this?
Maybe just before midnight? I'm not positive.
Gabby wrote 12 a.m. as the last seen point in her notebook, along with a question mark. So, Ben left Rachel out there? She didn't try to hide her suspicion. If Ben had given his friends an excuse for that, she wanted to know what it was before grilling him. Susan's greenish eyes begged for a break in the questioning. Footsteps shuffled behind her.
They'd had an argument.
The husband, Nadal, stood between Detective DeMarco and Officer Kelly. Both cops looked at him as though he'd defied orders. He ignored them, gesturing with an open palm toward his wife.
She should know, Susie, or else it won't make sense.
He faced Gabby.
Ben and Rachel got into a disagreement at dinner, and then Rachel went out to the beach for some air.
Gabby checked her notes.
For 2 hours?
I think they were both embarrassed at having argued publicly, Susan said. Ben went out to apologize. I assume Rachel wasn't ready to hear it.
What was the fight about?
Jason asked.
It...
Nadal started, but Susan cut him off.
You would have to ask Ben.
Susan pushed her right hand into the sand to help her up. Standing, she kept all her weight on her left foot. Gabby tried the question again.
But you heard them argue.
That doesn't mean we know what it was really about. Married couples fight. You should ask Ben. I'd only be guessing, and I'd rather not.
Gabby made a note to return to the subject with Susan later, after she'd talked to Rachel's husband. And you saw Ben return to the house after trying, unsuccessfully, to make up with his wife? Susan wrapped her arms around herself.
I think so. I saw him go around to the driveway. Their bedroom's on the first floor, near the front door. I'm sure he just got something from his car before going to bed.
Susan looked over her shoulder toward the dunes, shielding her eyes from the sun to see her rented house. She pointed toward a line of homes visible behind a strip of scrub forest.
He's probably there now.
Gabby asked for the address and made another note on her pad. The house was one of the handful of properties grandfathered into occupying the dunes themselves. Only people with a ton of money could afford those houses. A murdered woman in the Hamptons was already newsworthy. A murdered, wealthy, blonde mom would be a front-page story.
Gabby felt her jaw tighten at the thought of the attention.
Rachel Klein's kids would be going through enough without the media speculating about what their dad had done. To spare them, she'd have to solve this quickly.
You can't think Ben had anything to do with this, can you?
Susan's face crumpled like a plastic bumper in a collision.
She's his wife. It must have been someone who saw her on the beach alone and thought.
Susan's brown hair swished around her face from her vehement head shakes.
You saw how we found her. Her neck? Ben couldn't have. He wouldn't. God, I should have checked on her.
We have to inform him. Gabby placed her notebook back in the interior pocket of her jacket. As she lowered her hand, she let it graze against the bulge of the Glock. She'd never pointed her gun in the line of duty, let alone shot it, but she'd also never tangled with a murderer. Gabby waved the men toward them before gesturing to Susan. Please take us to the house. Chapter 5. The day of. The Atlantic Ocean spread out in front of Jenny, a mattress topped with a rumpled sheet of blue, green, and silver. In her peripheral vision, she watched an invisible hand grasp the silken edges at the shore and raise the fabric. Each time, the cloth settled more wrinkled than the last, forcing the frustrated hand to keep lifting and lowering it. The repetitive rustle of these waves echoed the thud of Jenny's feet. Routine was the solace of the endurance athlete. She could endure anything as long as it followed a pattern. Jenny ran along the shoreline, restoring her energy through her favorite activity. The outgoing tide had packed the sand into a semi-firm clay that kept her sneakers from sinking in with each stride. As she advanced toward the jetty, the anxious energy that had accumulated in her muscles drained from her limbs. Her legs loosened, her heart rate normalized, her breathing steadied. This was her release. Since childhood, the act of putting one foot in front of the other, of moving away from whatever had come before, had always made her feel better. She'd turned her coping mechanism into a competitive sport, racing long distance in high school and college. Medaling had never been her primary objective, though. Jenny ran to remember herself and regain control.
Jen!
The sound of her name distorted the rhythm of her footfalls. She stopped and whirled toward the call. Ben emerged from a path cut into the scrub forest on the side of the house, just beyond the view of the glass wall. He cradled a paper grocery bag in his hands. Jenny cursed under her breath. Either her neighbors were toasting and Ben was calling her back to clink glasses, or he wanted to discuss what had happened after she'd given him that last injection. The thought of doing either made Jenny want to sprint in the opposite direction. Alcohol was prohibited on her pain medication. She couldn't confess that fact, however, without also fielding questions about why she was taking pills in the first place. And that was between her and Lewis. Ben set down the brown bag to wave her over. She filled her lungs and walked to where he stood beside the bent trunk of a pine tree.
Hey. Jenny tried to sound happy to see him.
I was wondering where you'd run off to.
Ben's thin lips parted in a half smile. It was the controlled expression of a person pleased about something, yet trying to keep that beneath the surface. Jenny turned up her palms.
You found me.
I did. I thought after all that time in the car with Lewis, you might need to settle your nerves with a run.
Jenny felt her own lips press into a line. It was one thing for her to complain about her husband, in confidence, during a moment of frustration, but it was quite another for Ben to bring it up. Lewis drove fine, actually, no weaving in and out of traffic or blasting the horn.
Ben's smile receded.
For once.
I really only wanted to stretch my legs.
His eyes ran from her calves up to the several inches of exposed thigh. The brief look made her painfully aware of how little her husband would appreciate her seemingly sneaking off to chat with the neighborhood's Magic Mike, as Lewis referred to Ben behind his back. Ben's job, taking care of his two kids and self-publishing mystery novels, Lewis insisted, was a cover for his real role of looking attractive for and catering to his wife. The sun beating down on Jenny's head seemed to get stronger. A droplet of sweat ran down the back of her neck.
Well, I should get back inside, she started toward the house. As she passed, she felt a soft pat on her bare shoulder.
Hey, Jen.
She faced Ben, willing him not to ask what he'd been gearing up to with the pleasantries. His dark blue eyes probed her expression. As they did, his brow pinched above his Roman nose.
Is everything all right?
The unexpected question made Jenny feel suddenly exposed. Despite Lewis's dismissal of Ben as a pretty boy toy, he wasn't shallow or unintelligent. He was strangely empathetic, in fact, with an uncanny ability to pick up on body language. She'd personally witnessed his eerie ability to read people before. Jenny forced a smile.
I'm fine.
His eyes narrowed.
Beneath your eye, Jen.
Her hand flew to the spot, betraying that she knew exactly which eye had the problem. The heat was apparently melting her makeup. She needed to slip back into the house and reapply before anyone else noticed.
Oh, that,
she yawned. All the camp packing kept me up the past few nights. Dark circles. Ben hunched his shoulders and lowered his head to meet her gaze.
Jenny, that's not from being tired.
She was tempted to tell Ben it was none of his business, but she didn't want to start an entire week on a confrontational note with one of her housemates. The vacation with the neighbors, which Lewis had wanted to go on so badly 3 months earlier, would be difficult enough without her making things any more awkward.
Well, I don't know what you're seeing. I should run to the bathroom and check it out.
She brushed past him and began jogging to the house, knowing he couldn't catch her with his arthritic knee. With luck, Jenny thought, she'd make it to her room before anyone else spied the truth written on her face. Chapter 6. The Day Of. Susan should have stuck with wine. Like any good Catholic, she'd first tasted it at age 8, forcing the bitter sip down her throat like expired cough medicine to satisfy her parents. She remembered her mother tapping the tip of her wrinkled nose and giggling, "It'll make you feel better in the future." That future had arrived long ago. Wine had become the dessert in Susan's regular diet. Since moving east, she'd gotten into the habit of uncorking a red every other day. Right after tucking in the boys, she'd fill a goblet, sit on her couch, and alternate between sipping and swirling the viscous liquid until only dregs remained. Wine was her companion all those evenings when Nadal worked past 9. It quieted her when she really wanted to talk to someone about Jamal's impossible-to-explain new math worksheets, or Jonah's latest space model, or how much more taxing homeschooling an autistic child was compared to her former career as an attorney. As her mother had promised, wine definitely made her feel better. Champagne was not wine. Bubbles ruined the experience. They acted like out-of-control electrons, charging the liquid surface so that it prickled her tongue, sapping the juice of its sugary sedative qualities. Half a glass in, Susan could already feel the carbonated alcohol fizzing in her brain. She listened to Nadal, Rachel, and Lewis chat in the kitchen, painfully aware of the IQ points dissolved by her drink. What could she contribute to a business conversation between people who measured their worth in quantifiable dollars? She knew nothing about the economy anymore. She barely read the newspaper. The year at home, focused on elementary homework and imparting basic social graces, had reduced her to a simpleton. "It's definitely not imminent." Nadal eyed Rachel as he responded, though it had been Lewis who'd asked whether he'd be traveling soon for an IPO roadshow. "We're considering some investment bank bids for a future offering. That much has been reported, but we're not pouncing on anything. It's been helpful to be in New York and get a real feel for how Wall Street views the company, as opposed to tech investors. Those guys can be a bit exuberant when it comes to anything they can slap a disruptive label on. I still have to see how some things shake out before I make any moves." "Like the insurance thing?" Lewis sipped his drink. Susan couldn't tell from his tone whether he'd made a statement or asked a question. Nadal shrugged and splashed more scotch into his tumbler, an unusual act for him given the relatively early hour. He brought his drink to the fridge, pulled back the freezer door, and palmed a couple of oblong cubes from the ice tray. Susan couldn't blame him for discussing work. Though Nadal had tried to change the subject several times, Lewis and Rachel had kept bringing it back to his firm.
"I think the insurance question has pretty much been decided."
The freezer shut with a decisive clap.
"Doc2Go is a tech company, not a medical group."
Ice cubes clinked in Nadal's glass.
"We're like a ride-sharing service, but our drivers are physicians willing to make house calls. Essentially, they're independent contractors, operating under their own malpractice policies. Our riders are patients, willing to pay cash up front and seek later reimbursement from their health insurer."
Nadal swirled his whiskey as he answered. When he finished, he took a long sip. "Those companies cover their drivers when they're working," Rachel quipped. Lewis raised his glass in her direction.
"There you go."
Nadal set his drink back on the counter.
"Bad analogy, then. Think of Doc2Go as an interactive directory or online marketplace."
Though Nadal sounded measured as always, Susan caught a flash in his dark eyes as he stared at Rachel.
"Doctors who use it have to have their own malpractice insurance to compensate for any unintentional pain and suffering."
Lewis stared into his glass as if tea leaves had settled into the bottom. His eyebrows shrugged as he took a swig.
"Doc2Go also helps the whole system by keeping people with minor issues from clogging emergency rooms."
Again, Nadal gestured to Lewis.
"You're in the ER. You know that, hey. You don't have to convince me of the premise. I've used it, as you're well aware."
Lewis set his glass down and drummed his fingers against the sides.
"I think, though, in the rare instances when something unforeseen happens, the company that matched the doctor and patient should share the cost of remedying the situation, the way a hospital does. Doc2Go is taking part of the doctor's fee, after all."
Nadal rubbed the side of his nose with his knuckle. Susan understood the scratch to be a display of annoyance. Doc2Go was Nadal's other child, conceived without her, and, Susan suspected, loved more because of the lack of outside input. He'd invented it, coded it into existence, and established all the necessary relationships to set it up in the world. Even with nearly 100 people working for him, it operated according to the rules he'd programmed into its DNA and the connections he'd forged. It was as pure a legacy as anyone could ever have. As a result, he tended to take criticism of it, or the amount of time he spent with it, as a personal attack.
Speaking of fees, this place doesn't have any for the beach.
Susan walked over to her husband and wrapped an arm around his waist. Anyone want to check it out? Jenny's already there, probably getting even more bronze. She glanced at her exposed arms, made whiter beside Nadal's brown ones.
I need some color, right, hun?
Rachel glanced over her shoulder. Is Ben out there? Susan realized she hadn't been the only person not contributing to the conversation. Ben hadn't returned after slipping outside to retrieve more stuff from his car.
Maybe he's...
How much of the cost, Lewis?
Susan had been about to suggest that Ben had left to buy food, but Nadal's terse question shifted talk back to his company.
We're charging a flat fee of $50 to set up the visit and process the payment, Nadal added. That's less than 10% of what the doctor typically makes. Hospitals, on the other hand, claim far more and often employ the physicians.
The back door opened with a whoosh of air. Susan breathed the incoming scent of the ocean and exhaled. The presence of somebody else uninvolved in the tense discussion would help break it up. Jenny or Ben could easily swing the topic toward some safe, guy-friendly arena like the NBA Finals or professional golf. Jenny stood in front of the wall of windows, pixelated by the bright sunlight streaming behind her.
It's gorgeous out there.
Her backlit form doubled over to untie her sneakers. Susan pounced on the new topic.
It's supposed to be one of the best beaches in the Northeast. Not too hot and not too crowded, since you have to be in one of the houses to gain access.
Jenny didn't comment on whether Susan's research was right. Instead, she finished removing her shoes and headed toward the stairs, her tall, athletic form coming into focus as she strode further into the room. Still, having stared at the bright windows, Susan's eyes struggled to adjust. Lewis stood from his seat at the breakfast bar and opened his arms. Chivalry withstood a decade-long marriage, Susan supposed, when the wife looked like Jenny. She needed to make more of an effort to spruce up around Nadal.
Hey, honey, Lewis said. How was the run?
Jenny stopped several feet from her husband at the edge of the staircase.
Good. I'm sweaty, though. I should shower.
Did you see Ben out there?
The change in Rachel's relaxed expression told Susan something was wrong. Rachel's eyebrows had squeezed together, deepening the lines that stamped all women past a certain age.
What happened to your eye?
Jenny's fingertips fled to her left cheekbone.
Oh, is it swelling?
It looks bruised.
Susan strained to see the cause for concern. Jenny's hand covered nearly the whole left side of her face, and she had dropped her head too, swinging her hair over her eye, like a brunette Jessica Rabbit.
It's the silliest thing. I was running and—
Let me see.
Lewis walked over to his wife, partially blocking Susan's view. He held Jenny's chin and tilted it upright. She let her hand drop, revealing a shimmery yellow patch on her brown skin that faded into a violet swath. Instinctively, Susan pivoted to the freezer and withdrew a handful of ice. Raising twin boys had turned her into a triage officer.
Are you okay?
She scanned the kitchen for a paper towel roll.
Did you trip or—
That looks like a really bad bite, honey.
Lewis released her chin.
Maybe a mosquito or a spider. Your skin is so sensitive.
Jenny nodded. I should put some anti-inflammatory ointment on it.
Rachel took several steps toward Jenny for her own examination.
You wouldn't think the beach would be so buggy in June. I mean, to get bit on your face?
While running?
It's not teeming with insects or anything. Jen retreated from Rachel, withdrawing into her husband.
It probably happened earlier, and you're only now having the reaction. Blood flow and heat always makes any skin injury worse.
Lewis brushed his wife's hair from her face.
You should go upstairs, babe. Wash off any irritants that might be exacerbating the reaction. There's Benadryl in the front pocket of my suitcase. I'll bring you a cold compress.
Jenny bolted toward the stairs. A loud crack stopped her as she reached the mezzanine. The front door was opening.
Hey, everybody, I got dinner.
Ben's voice reverberated in the hallway. The sound seemed to hasten Jenny's sprint to the second floor. Susan winced as she watched her run up the modern staircase, hand barely brushing the thin metal railing affixed to one side. The cement floor would not forgive a fall. Nadal started toward the front door.
The bags might be heavy.
Susan remembered the ice freezing her palm. A roll of paper towels peeked from behind the swan-necked kitchen faucet. She peeled off a sheet, dropped in the cubes, and then twisted it into a little pouch. I know an ice pack would be better. Susan passed the makeshift satchel to Lewis.
Thanks.
He accepted it with a shake of his head.
Her skin blows up at the slightest thing.
She does get a lot of bruises, Lewis.
Rachel's arms folded across her chest. Perhaps you should look into why. Lewis started toward the stairs.
Maybe an iron deficiency or too little vitamin C.
Does Jenny need orange juice? Susan shouted after him. I can grab some in town.
That bug must have been a big sucker. Beneath her left eye is all swollen and black.
Rachel's mouth drew into a line. She gave Ben a pointed look as he came into the kitchen, communicating in the silent language of long-term partners. Susan couldn't interpret what had been said, but she knew information had been exchanged. Paper rustled. Ben clenched the sides of the grocery bag as though it threatened to slip from his hands. He called up to Lewis on the landing.
What bitter, Lewis? I'm an ER surgeon, not an entomologist.
Lewis mimicked the cadence of Dr. McCoy as he delivered his one-liner. The quip failed to elicit a chuckle from any of the concerned faces in the room. Lewis shrugged, like a comedian used to some jokes falling flat, and headed toward the bedroom. The door clicked shut behind him.